back to Wild Game Dynasty, folks. This is Gary Morgan, and I really appreciate you dialing in to our podcast platform. Yes, we're up to 134 podcasts in the last, oh, probably 2-3 years. And for that, we really say thanks to you for taking time out of your busy schedule. You could be doing a whole bunch of different things, but you made a choice to listen to what we have to offer. There's probably a gold nugget in several of these that you, then that's the reason why you've dialed in and listened in. And of course, you probably recognize several of these folks, but we have some really special people. Today is no different. We have really an outstanding person. He's a repeat performer, as we call, Jerry Everhart. Please listen to this gentleman's explanation of the white-tailed deer rut. It is critically important for those that really want to grasp all the facts. They're going to want to dial into this fella, we say. And well, instead of me rambling on, because his podcast is a bit long, I'm going to say it's pushing an hour. Normally I like to keep it around 35 minutes, but it is well worth your time. I will guarantee it. Let's roll right into podcast episode 134. Jerry Everhart, this is Gary Morgan calling.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Oh, not too bad. I appreciate you answering your phone. I mean, with caller ID and all that, I can't say you weren't forewarned that I was calling. You could have pressed the ignore button or pretended to be the recording and say, you know, our phone is out of order. But I appreciate you answering the phone, and I know better than that. I know who you are and what you're made of, we'll call it. And I always, always enjoy doing a podcast with Jerry Everhart. It's just a treat. It really is. So thank you for agreeing to this time and sharing it with the listeners as well.
Well, Gary, it's good to talk to you. It always is. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you again. We'll have to do it live again here in the future.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
We need to contact each other since we both will be in the same state.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. And I'm a little closer than I was to that Upper Peninsula cottage area that you're in. And, of course, you know, it'd be a treat to stop and say hi, and maybe we can go have a lunch somewhere, or maybe show me around a little bit on your boat or whatever's going on that day. So there's many things to do, as we know, up there.
Sounds good, Gary.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Jerry, I remember our past two podcasts, but I most remember the visit that I had with you, and it lasted longer than we anticipated because there's so many things to talk about when it comes to deer hunting, animals, critters, whatever it might be, the wildlife, we'll say. But you shared some information with me that was just so intriguing, and it still is to this day. And you have a profession that you retired from that gave you an opportunity to actually apply some of that, we'll call it research or data, to the hunting field, because you were that person that at your workplace that was also an avid bow hunter, and people kind of knew you for two reasons, obviously for your profession, but also what you did in your private life as a hobby, and that was hunting. And I remember listening to you tell that story, and it was just a fun conversation. But that's kind of where I want to pick up where we kind of left off, is kind of almost regurgitate a lot of this same information, because some of it has been further refined, as you shared with me.
I'm available to talk about most anything.
Good.
So we'll give it a try.
Well, give us a slight background in where you worked. It certainly wasn't just a 9-to-5 program. It certainly wasn't making widgets. Nothing wrong with that. But you had a very interesting career. Share with that just a little bit, and how it bled into what you do today as a hunting person, a conservationist.
Well, I started out in the electrical engineering area, and I applied for a job at a laboratory that was run by the, at that time, the Atomic Energy Commission, and later the Department of Energy, which ended up being a part of our defense program. So I moved from mostly electronics to measurements of mostly mass at that time, mass measurements. So I became a person that worked in the measurements of mass, and then that knowledge led me to move to any kind of measurement processes. So technically, I was called a metrologist, and that's the science of measurements rather than weather, which is a little different. When you tell someone you were a metrologist, they think you were going to predict the weather. Well, I was a metrologist, which was actually the science of measurements, measuring. So I worked in making measurements. At that same time, I was introduced to the archery, to a bow. A gentleman in my church had a recurve and shooting recurve, and he would go to southeastern Ohio and hunt deer, and he wanted to know if I was interested in shooting a bow. So I did. I bought me a bear bow and recurve and began shooting, and then thus I started hunting deer. And of course, hunting was the right term because there were not many deer to hunt. So
that
dates back many years ago. So I started keeping information. Well, I'll have to back up a little bit. In those years, archery was really getting started, and we had a great archery shop and organization in our area. In fact, Fred Bear came there a couple times, and I had the opportunity to meet him, and I never will forget. He told me he was talking about what was most important about hunting deer, and he said one thing is to remember as you go through the woods or you're hunting deer, which is mostly still hunting in those days. If you were hunting deer, you got to remember they're not on the timetable. They don't have to come back to the truck at noon. So if you want to see the deer, you better move slower than they do.
Yeah.
And that's true. And the other thing he said was keep good notes. He kept his field notes, a ledger. So I started just writing down the day I hunted, where I was at, what I saw, and didn't see. And I did that for years. I've always done that every day.
That takes some discipline right there.
Well, it really wasn't very fancy, just a little notebook that you wrote down the date and what you saw and didn't see and so forth. So then I realized that a few more notes might be important, so I kept that. Anyway, as time passed and we had more deer, I began to understand that there was only certain times of the year that I saw any bucks to mount anything. And see, a good buck would be rare, and I realized that was a certain time of the year in the fall. So it didn't take much for me to figure out that the rut had something to do with it, the breeding of the deer. That being said, I got inquisitive about what is it that causes them? When is it that they get active? I wanted to know when the best time to go hunting. And I started then compiling that data. I looked at the data and looked at when I saw good deer, when I had shots, or when in that, and many years passed, when I shot deer, shot bucks. And then I started to look at it and find out it had to be within a week or two of the fall. And I started correlating that data and realized that it wasn't very predictable. I was tying it to the day. So that day this year was not, I didn't see the same thing the next day or the year after. So you did a podcast with a gentleman named John Azaga. And Azaga is a very knowledgeable person in deer. And at that time, he was publishing some articles, and I remember him talking about what causes the deer to go into the rut, into estrus, and it's the does that cause it. And he said it was the sunlight, the change in the sunlight. And we all predicted it had to be the cold or the temperature or whatever. So then I started looking at sunlight, and I started trying to look at the days in terms of sunlight. And that's what led me to come to a value of analyzing the curve of the sunlight. So then I put the sightings that I had over the many years. I'm talking about 20 years of data.
Wow.
And I would look at this and say, wow, now it relates to that change in sunlight. So basically, I use the rate of change of sunlight to predict when you're most likely to see good bucks, deer. You'll see all kinds of bucks and deer.
Yeah.
That's not the point. But it's that time that all deer hunters look for, that magic day or few days when you go to the woods and you see bucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's basically a background. I don't know if I explained that very well or not.
Well, did a great job, and I'm glad you did bring up John Ozaga, because cutting edge. You folks were taking notes and doing things that a lot of people weren't doing, and finding some correlations. And for that, we really appreciate it, because that's taken us to the next level and then some. And I'm glad that there are still people out there carrying that torch, because that's needed to improve the process, we'll say.
Right. And actually, I remember reading an article that John wrote way back saying that that there wasn't any much correlation in terms of mock scrapes and real scrapes. You didn't see a lot of the results in mock scrapes. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. But the point of it is, I coupled with that time prediction, I coupled with it scrapes.
Okay.
And I don't mean go in the woods and find a scrape, because it may not be suitable for your setup and so forth. I mean, I started making scrapes.
Mm.
So I started making mock scrapes way back before, but I think probably before anybody ever heard of anybody doing mock scrapes.
Yeah.
And then I realized, I watched them in these branches, the licking branches overhead. So I then picked up licking branches that's in the woods, that limb that sticks down, or limb or two that sticks down at a certain height. And then I saw them everywhere after that. And then I realized under a lot of them were scrapes.
Yeah.
So I started out in those early days hunting over scrapes, and natural scrapes. And
yes.
I did better than I did without them, but still didn't have a lot of good results. In other words, it was hit or miss, so to speak. So I coupled making licking branches and scrapes around my stand setup. So I did that, and then I used the actual prediction of when the rut starts, or when the key days are to hunt, based on the change in sunlight.
Yeah.
And then, wow, it's just like success. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
It is. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know a lot of people still question it. And like I said, early on, John wrote this article about making mock scrapes, and he didn't see any activity. And I remember he printed this, and I'm thinking, wow, first time I've ever read anything he and I just disagree with. You know, we disagree with him. And then later on, in fact, it was a few years later, he wrote another article or explained it, that he didn't put any scent on those scrapes. And he came back and said that he ran a test, an experiment with putting scent in the scrapes on the licking branches. And he said, but his mortality rate went up. In other words, he's studying deer within an enclosure.
Yes.
You know, which means they fought like crazy, these bucks did.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember hearing a little something about that. There was a lot of, we'll call it that, infighting, because they had nowhere to go but inside that 1 square mile, I think.
That's correct. And then I said, well, he's got it now, too. So anyway, that's basically what I use to become pretty successful at taking good bucks. And I don't mean I'm just a huge trophy hunter. I mean, I like venison, and I like to take venison. It doesn't have to be a trophy. You can shoot whatever you like, as long as it's legal, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But the prediction of the time is pretty very specific, and I know many of your listeners are going to have a hard time believing this, but I'm just going to tell you it's very specific.
Yeah.
And it's specific to that rate of change of light. So I did a little analysis, and the analysis of that originally was not too easy. In other words, I'm looking at the curve of light, and you do some propagation of the light curve. But first of all, you got to find out what curve, what change of light are you looking at?
Yeah.
So I had to go back and take the best opportunities that I had all those many, many years when I shot big bucks, when they were in those scrapes, when I saw this, and I narrowed it down to those days. And then I used those days to calculate what that tangent of that slope is. In other words, the slope is a tangent is a technical term, which means the amount of light per time.
Yeah.
It's in other words, it's the amount of light over the amount of time, physically calculation, and it comes up with a number, and that tells you what the curve is.
Wow.
The slope. And that slope then is once I came up with that number, I thought, this is pretty exciting. And then I started trying it.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't hunt a stand. I wouldn't go to a stand until it came to that date, that time.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing. I did have a problem because I was hunting. An area that might be, maybe 200 miles apart. And I would go there and hunt, and no success. And I come back to another place and it worked. So then I realized, wow, it's pretty specific to a location.
Yeah.
So because light change is different in different locations.
Yeah.
So it's specific to where you are at. So you have to look at it at where you are at. In other words, once you determine where it's at, say it in your county, around your area where you're hunting, it is specific. You can count on that slope. It'll be the same. That day the day that light change is correct. It'll be that day.
And we know that changes that. I mean, the day changes.
The calendar
from
day changes.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
It changes. It changes from year to year. It can change a couple days. One day is 2 or 3 days one way or another. It can vary as much as 4 days.
Let me ask.
On where you're at and change.
I have a question. Is this pretty specific to the large percentage of the deer populations, particularly whether it be the buck or the doe, but I mean, is it pretty specific to almost 100% of the population of the deer?
Well, whenever I did this and I started hunting those days, that key day, and I had no idea what did it, why, how specific it was. I just knew it was working.
Yeah.
But then with the biologists that we have today and the information that you can get from your biologist, you can find out that what triggers this whole thing is the doe.
Yeah.
The doe is the one that goes into estrus, and it's the change in light that causes that. Now, the change in light also causes the same thing. Some hormone changes in the buck. There's no question. In other words, they drop their antlers. It has to do again with change in light and so forth. It's regulated by that, but it's more specific to the doe. And of course, out of a population of say 10 does, the majority of them will be. I'm telling you, it'll be within that day.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean they'll be ready to breed that day, but I'm saying they're pretty specific down to the day. But there's always some of the older mature deer, older does will come in a day or so earlier, and there may be 1 out of 10 that will be off a day or so, and there'll be a couple out of 10 that will be late. You see what I mean?
Yeah. So, I mean,
but
we have a fluctuation of, say, we'll say 3 days.
Three does may act different, and the other 7 will be pretty concentrated to when that time is.
Wow.
Now, what I mean is, but here's what happens. We talk about stages of of the rut, of buck stages. Mm-hmm. We call it the seek stage, we call it the chase stage, and the breed stage. And a lot of people just don't understand, or we don't have, let's put it this way, we all don't have the same definition of what that means.
Right.
So I'm going to say the seek stage is when does smell like they're ready to mm-hmm. be bred, but they don't feel like it. And those bucks, which are running scrapes and moving at night, they decide to go to day and night because wow. there's this smell in the woods that they can't resist.
Yeah.
You see?
It makes perfect sense because... When we were out in Missouri, we had a scrape line that was changing every day. It was... I've not seen one in that one field like I've seen anywhere else. And one guy wanted to sit on it, and I just said, I'm not the expert, bud, but I said, this is nighttime activity. He says, no, not a chance. I said, you can sit here all you want. That's up to you. I said, but what I would do is put a camera. He says, I don't have the time. He says, I'm here for 6 days, and we're already into our start of our third day. I want to move. And he sat there for 3 days and didn't see a buck.
Yeah.
But that was all nighttime activity. You know,
it's all nighttime.
Yeah.
Most up until what I call the key day, and I call it the key day, it starts it. And that means that's the day I want to go to the woods and hunt.
Yes.
And that key day starts this seek, chase, breed
mm-hmm.
scenario.
Yeah.
And they're seeking, bucks are seeking at night, and they're seeking all the time for a week or two before this. We know mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. They're fighting a lot prior to this. But this is the time that the does start to smell like they're in estrus. And I have read a couple articles by some of these renowned biologists that say that a doe about 7 days before she's ready to breed will have like a false cycle or something like that. And she smells like she's ready, but she's not. And that's exactly what I see. When you see this buck come upon a doe during this seek stage, he'll take after it, and he don't have to get right behind it. He'll chase behind that doe. It's 20 yards, and it looks like they're chasing.
Yeah.
He's not chasing. He's checking.
Yeah.
And then they'll stop, and he'll turn around and go somewhere else.
Hmm.
Turn to the left or turn to the right.
Mm-hmm.
He's checked her, and she's not an estrus. And he's done, you know, but he's seeking and he's checking. And a lot of people think they're chasing because this buck's behind these does and they're just taking off.
Yeah.
That's not the chase stage.
Okay.
The chase stage is when smells right, feels right, and she'll run a ways and he'll stay behind her. He'll stop. She'll stop. That's the chase stage.
Okay.
They're with them. That's what I call a chase stage. They stay with each other because she is about ready to be going into it.
Is there?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Jerry. It's just so intriguing. It's just marvelous. Lockdown. Is that part of that lockdown?
It's later. Yes.
Okay.
Let me yep. try to. I found out that the seek stage lasts about 2 days to 3 days.
Hmm.
In other words, these bucks run day and night, checking does, but they're mostly checking scrapes. So if you got this scent, good doe in estrus in that scent, and on that licking branch before you're hunting over.
Yeah.
I mean good doe at that doe in estrus scent in the scrape, on that branch, around their stand where you're hunting, they could smell this out. I'm talking about 100 yards away.
Mm.
And they'll pick this up and come right there to check it because they haven't found a doe yet that's receptive.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so profitable to hunt over scrapes during this seek stage. These three days, it's unbelievable. If a buck picks that scent up and you've done your work and made those scrapes, he's got it already logged in his mind. He's checked that scrape when you made it and put scent in it weeks ago.
Yeah.
He knows it's there. So he checks that, whether it's on the trail he's coming up or whether it's over 50, 100 yards away.
Yeah.
And he's checking, wind checking, and when he smells that, he's like a beagle on a rabbit right to that, right
yeah.
to your stand.
Mm.
I hate to tell you how many bucks I've killed with their nose on the licking branch or in the scrape.
Wow.
I mean, it's just simply amazing. Anyway, back to the timing, 3 days.
Yep.
From the time that they go from day nighttime to day and night, less about 3 days before they're chasing. Sometimes they'll start chasing within the second day of it, third day. But then they're chasing, meaning the bucks and the does are more receptive for them to be with them, and they don't check scrapes as much. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you're hunting over the scrapes is really good for about 3 to 4 days, 3 days maybe, and then on the fourth, fifth day, it's harder to have them come right to those scrapes.
Yeah.
It's still good. I still hunt the scrapes. But my hope is that she's behind it. If he's behind that doe, she's gonna come through there, through that scrape area, and ultimately they'll stop and smell it on the way, and you got a shot.
Yeah.
So you got five to six good days of hunting over your setup with scrapes.
Mm.
After that, they're breeding, and when they're breeding, that's what I call lockdown.
Yeah. Okay.
They'll stay put pretty much with each other and so forth. I don't find it to be very easy after that fifth day. So you got about two to four good days. You see what I mean?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years ago, there was a scrape on an old ridge where there was an old, at best, a two-track. I call them skidder runs when they timbered it probably 30 years ago or more. And so I walked in that area to go back to a spot, and there was a line of scrapes, and I thought, well, this is every year. And the one scrape just looked marvelous that year. I thought, my goodness. So, you know, I'd walk around it, and I had my rubber boots on. I didn't touch any limbs, and, you know. So I was prepping a spot for a gentleman, and that's where he wanted to set during gun season. And I said to him, he said, what do you think? And I said, how's my spot look? And I said, good. We should go back there. I said, no, we'll go back. You know where it's at. Anyway, they said, I think you ought to modify your sit. I said, sit 2 days at this scrape. Why is that? I said, because they're coming in there. Well, it's nighttime. I think it is, too, but you never know, bud. I said, even if you get it 10 minutes before, you know, last light. And he didn't. It wasn't his fault. You know, he was playing the odds, and I put a camera there, and we're sitting at the cabin on the 13th before the open, you know, 2 days before the opener, and I showed him where this doe would come in there. We had the does were visiting that like crazy. I see there was three or four, I thought, different does, and then that one buck would come in. They'd always stand on their hind legs, every one of them, even the does. This one doe tried wrapping its front leg around that limb almost, and pulling on it. And it was trying to grab it, and every time it tried to grab it with its teeth, or its, you know, it was just, but, and then finally it showed up during the day. He wasn't sitting there, but that's the way it went, you know. But it lasted for, like you say, just that really short time. But they didn't seem a bit concerned about the human activity, which is only one time a year where that's at. There's just nobody that goes back there. But they didn't seem concerned about it. They were locked into what they were doing. I hate to use the word locked in on this one, but they were all engrossed in what was going on in their breeding cycle, and that was the end of it. And I thought, boy, that would have been a perfect scenario for somebody to, you know, just all your marbles in one spot, and this is it. But anyways, that for what you're saying.
Understanding.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just remember that, and I remember talking to this guy, Brian, about your podcast before, and he said, I got to listen to that. And I said, well, you know, I think you should listen to it, but it's the information that I garnered from it that tells me you should sit there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we both are talking about is understanding these phases. In other words, once you understand these phases, you will learn some key things to do. One is, do not hunt that stand too early. I used to do that. I used to go to southeastern Ohio and hunt, and I'd use my key day calculation And I'd go down there and hunt because I knew it was time to hunt here, in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I mean, in the western part of the state. And then I didn't have any success. I found out then it's different there than it is here.
Wow.
So there's a difference of about a day and a half to 2 days difference
between
there and here.
Because of the light?
Because of the light.
Okay.
And it's more significant when you go north and south.
Oh.
It's more significant.
Well, that makes sense sure.
So you got to, first of all, understand the stages. Understand the stage of when they start seeking and throw caution to the wind, and they're going to go to that smell of doe estrus because it's in the woods, and they haven't found one yet.
Yeah.
So that's when you're your best chance.
Yeah.
And you got three good days. And then when they start to chase, be in a place to where that activity is going to happen around your scrapes and about where you're at. And then you got 2 or 3 days, you might want to go, unless it's gun season, and you can reach out and touch them.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to go rest up for a few days.
Yeah.
Because then go back.
Well, I remember you talking about that before, yeah.
Because whenever they've bred most of those does, the bigger bucks will start to roam again.
Mm.
They will be out roaming again, seeking this doe that hasn't been bred yet.
Wow.
And like I said, there'll be a few of them that came in late, more than ones that come in early.
Yeah.
So they're out looking. So you can count, for example, you can count. First 3 days, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Next 2 to 3 days, pretty good.
Yeah.
I've hunted 6 days. I'm taking off 3 days.
Yeah. Yep.
Then come back and hunt the next 4 days because the big bucks will be roaming, looking for another one in daylight again. So use your sense. Use it. I mean, use your doe and estrus scent. Use your scrapes. Use your setups because it will happen.
Wow.
And what happens is, in some cases, for example, In Upper Michigan, folks think the rut in Upper Michigan happens in November, late middle of November, the breeding.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's earlier up there than it is in the Midwest down here. It happens much earlier than most people think. So when they see these bucks behind these does around opening of gun season, they're in that later stage of seek.
Mm,
you see
okay.
what I mean?
Yep.
Here, these bucks are behind those does looking for one which would be, not the best time to hunt.
Right.
It's there because that's your best opportunity. And besides, you've got the tools, the rifle to set up at long distance.
You bet. Absolutely.
So that's why that opener is a good time to hunt there.
Yeah.
I would add to this. If you're going to have a setup to hunt, it's important that you make these licking branches and these scrapes not just out in front of your stand. You want them to your left, to your front, and to your right.
Like in a half moon type thing?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't care about them being to my back. And I always make my stands to where I come in. However I get to my stand, I approach the stand to the back, to my back when I'm on the stand.
Okay.
In other words, you walk in, wherever you're coming in, how you get there, the trail you come in on, you use scent pads and use that scent on your pad to walk in. So hopefully they'll pick that up and trail you in and then come on past you because then you walk down a trail, doctor the scrapes and the licking branches all the way around your stand, take your pads off, and go up your tree or in your blind. So then what you've done is you've created a box around you.
Yeah.
It don't have to be square.
Uh-huh.
It can be a semicircle. It depends upon which way the trails go.
Okay.
And if you don't have the trails, make one.
Okay.
If you got two down the side, you don't have one across the front, just go cut one and tie down some branches.
Yeah.
And if you do that, say, for example, on the 1st of October, believe me, they'll be there come November.
Mm.
I have never had a case where I've tied down licking branches and made box scrapes. I haven't had them to use it. Never. They always use it.
When you, we call it doctored up, put that What kind of scent are you using? Not necessarily the brand, but I mean, what kind of?
Doan estrus.
Okay, that's what I thought. Just for the listeners.
No, maximum Doan estrus. I don't use buck estrus. I only use Doan estrus.
Okay.
Now here's the reason why. I experimented with that too. I experimented with all kinds of scent, doe, buck scent, and I don't know. I even use skunk scent. Mm-hmm. I've made a lot of mistakes.
Well, I've used that stuff too, and I remember every bit of it.
Yeah, it didn't work. No. But yeah. Anyway, what it is whenever a buck sheds his velvet, he's interested.
Yeah.
He's interested. I have pictures, photos, many of them, of bucks still in the velvet running scrapes.
Hmm.
I mean, they haven't shed their velvet yet, and they're in a scrape.
Yeah.
You make it scrape. And they're always on licking branches. Every deer's on licking branches.
Yeah.
And normally there's a scrape, good scrape under on some of those licking branches anyway.
I remember you saying that every scrape will have a licking branch, but not every licking branch will have a scrape.
Exactly. Exactly. But if you will make the scrape under that licking branch,
yeah,
you've got a scrape.
When you make
just
those,
because they don't go and open it up,
right?
I mean, they don't check it. They still check them all.
When you do that, obviously you're protecting your scent.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Okay,
I'm putting myself in a box of no matter which way the breeze is blowing, I have my scent, personal scent, is covered by the scent of this Doan estrus.
And you wear too. I mean, to kind of take it to that next conversation. You're protecting your scent, but you're also protecting the scent you give off while in the woods making those.
That's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Okay. My human scent is overshadowed by the fact that they're out locating that Doan estrus scent. That's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
So when they pick that up, they don't care where, they're not as apt to think there's a human there.
Yeah.
So they're not tip checking me.
Yeah. You get that three and a half year old on up. That
yep.
Wants so bad to be there, but if he senses that, something's up, you know, I'll come back later.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're fooling, you're literally taking the pressure off of your ability to be detected.
Yeah.
Whether it's your detection has decreased significantly because they are really looking for that Doan estrus scent,
mm-hmm.
and they smell it.
Is it,
and
would it be appropriate to call that some sort of nose jamming?
Well, it is similar to nose jamming. That's exactly it. You're doing the same thing.
Yeah, okay.
You're doing the same thing as nose jamming. Yeah.
Yeah. When I used that comment one time. I remember a guy, one of our client hunters, says, well, I don't have that stuff with me. I said, what do you mean? Oh, they sell that nose jamming. I said, I'm really not talking about the substance. I'm talking about the concept.
That's correct. Yeah, they came out with the substance after I come up with the concept.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Yep.
Exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And I do know friends, associates that have used that product, and it is successful.
Yeah,
but I don't want to just jam their nose.
No.
I want them to not – I want them to smell that scent. In other words, people – really put a lot of emphasis on wind direction and setting their stand up for prevailing wind direction.
Mm-hmm.
When you're hunting those few days, you don't really care about the wind direction.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking back when I brought this up a little bit ago. But, you know, just again, it was I don't have enough data to conceptualize that to be my theory,
I do.
But you do, and I know that.
I've got a lot of data.
Yes, exactly. That's why I brought that up about that scrape, that really beautiful-looking scrape that was on her trail going in, and then, you know, put a trail camera there, and holy smokes, we'd have never thought. Yeah, you see the tracks and that, but I'm thinking, I'm not sitting there. That's nighttime activity. Okay, you know, that's up to you. It's your hunt, bud. But, and it wasn't knocking him. It was just, you know, he's a very good hunter. But like you say, wow, that's amazing, though. So the scent is not so critical as far as human scent, but it is. But we should still, if I can talk, we should still treat it as such, as in we don't want to wear our hunting clothes to the breakfast table.
I am a scent control fanatic.
I know.
It's true. I go to a lot of trouble to control my scent. I did because I learned that early on before I learned how to use these scrapes to cover my scent. And I've never been unsuccessful by controlling my scent. So
yeah.
I've always done the same routine. My clothes are in certain containers and bags. I only wear inner clothes one time, and they go through a special washing process. I am scent conscious,
yes.
Very scent conscious.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, if you want to fool a big mature buck, you'll fool him those few days.
Yeah. Wow. Let me ask you too. We talked about this in the previous podcast, I think. And I remember when I was at your cottage, we talked about this at length because it really intrigued me. But you talked about the tinker stands. And we haven't discussed that yet, but I mean, because one guy says to me, really, Wes, you're kind of nailing it down. We only get to hunt 3 or 4 times a year. That's even any good. I said, I didn't say that, bud. But I said, you should treat that special place that you like. I mean, if it's your, what you want to call your piece of heaven in the woods, you know, don't go in there and stink it up, you know, save it. But you can still, you know, a distance away from that one, I'm not talking 100 yards, but maybe several miles down the road, you'll have other spots.
Exactly.
And if you're lucky enough to fill a tag and harvest a nice buck or whatever it is that you're looking for, great.
And that's exactly my philosophy. That's what I've done over the years.
Yeah.
I have what I consider to be the best rut stand, in other words, the best key day stand. And I have other stands that's pretty good too. And I have taken some nice bucks prior to that as key days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can talk about, well, when's that? Well, you know, it's about 2 weeks before that key day. Anywhere from 2 weeks up until the last 2 or 3 days before those key days is good.
Yeah.
Now, the day before the key days, I don't know why. I can't understand it. But the woods just kind of shuts down. You think there's nothing there.
Wow.
So I have learned, don't go early. And if you hunt your stand early, I've done some work on this, kept some data. If I hunted my stand, and I'm not on my data, but I've analyzed the data of my hunting friends.
Yeah.
If you go to that stand before that key day starts, you will cut your odds by 70%.
Oh my gosh, it's not worth
it. In other words, you're leaving enough scent. They know you're there somehow. I don't know how they know you're there, but then they avoid that location. From that time on. So
yeah.
Now you can hunt it early in the season, maybe a month ahead, and get by with it one time.
Yeah.
But don't hunt that stand 2 days, 3 days, or the day before the key day and think you're going to go in the key day and use it. You better save that stand.
Yeah.
Because you're cutting your odds down.
So
really cutting them down.
But
the tinker stand is important.
Yeah.
Keep stands that you can hunt. And I don't have a stand, period, that isn't set up with scrapes.
Yeah.
They all are.
Yeah.
I have a blind that I will use for late season, and I rarely have had to use it once or twice in my life because I'm normally successful before then. But if for some reason, and in my case, it's not because I didn't get this chance to shoot it at a deer. It's the fact that I spent time tracking or in the woods and looking to see if I had mortally shot a deer.
Yeah.
That stand up. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to have a couple good key rut stands. See?
Yeah, absolutely.
That you leave alone because you never know what's going to happen at one of those stands. You may have to have a backup.
Yeah.
But every stand is set up the same way with the scrapes. Even a blind that I hunt a food plot with, I have scrapes set up around that. In fact, I would venture to say, even in late season, rut's all over, the deer's been, you know, those have been bred, but still they're coming to food, instead of basically thinking about breeding,
mm-hmm.
they still check those scrapes of licking branches.
Wow.
And I hate to tell you how many times they'll check that scrape and licking branch before they'll go to the food source.
Wow.
So
that's amazing.
I use scrapes and licking branches, licking branches and scrapes, no matter what stand I hunt.
Mm. Wow, Jerry. This is awesome stuff. I mean, we have really covered just it's a compressed, if we compressed it, it's really this topic isn't, I mean, I guess maybe for me to better explain it, because I'm not real good at that sometimes, but we've complicated this as hunters, as a group of hunters. Everybody's got a different concept, the moon phase, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And,
right.
And of course, it's usually often about other reasons for that. And but I don't want to say we screwed it up, because I guess everybody teach their own. But this is really cool stuff, but it's really not that difficult. It's just a new
if you're not doing it, it's
just a new way.
No. We had a very, as you well know, you've been on it, a very successful podcast.
Yes.
I did it for 10 years. One of the most successful podcasts.
Yep.
And we were early in our stages doing it, and we had a lot of naysayers. No.
You bet.
But basically, we had people that was doing it, and we had hundreds of people that hunted those key days and came back with the results of what has happened. But at that time, I was talking and doing podcasts with celebrities.
Wow.
It was hard to tell these celebrities,
oh, yeah.
Look, you want to up your odds, make these scrapes and licking branches and set these aside until then. And instead of trying to shoot 60 yards with your bow across your food plot, yeah. Try to get them right on this side of your food plot, right in the edge of the woods on these scrapes. You couldn't hardly get anybody to listen to me, Gary. Yeah.
They just kind of smiled and winked at you.
Right. And now you see the same people on some of these television programs are literally making scrapes.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So we were way ahead of our time.
Absolutely. I didn't want to use that thing, but you're absolutely right on that. Yep.
Yeah. So basically, everybody knows these scrapes are important. The only thing they don't know is maybe don't hunt your stand. A lot of people know don't hunt your stands too much. It does not work. A lot of studies there. But the other thing is to try to time when you're hunting it. And I'll have to go back and mention again, the timing is it's important. And how I want to describe this is, let's say, for example, I know what day it is to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, for example, this year, it happens to be at my location. It happened to be November the 9th was the best day to go.
Wow.
Okay. Now, if I wanted to hunt north of here, say 20 miles, it wasn't the 9th.
Wow, that short of a distance.
20 miles north of here, that short of a distance. This range of timing is different from the geographic location of the United States is different all over.
Yeah.
It's because the rate of change of sunlight is different in the UP than it is in Mississippi.
Basically because of the curvature of the earth, north or south of the equator then.
North to south, you're right.
Okay.
It changes a lot more north to south than it does east to west.
Yeah.
East to west makes some changes.
Mm-hmm.
So all I'm saying is once you keep this information and you find out, oh, I know what the day is. I saw this happen. I know this is when I need to be there. Then it's going to be the same, not that calendar day, but that amount of sunlight is going to be the same from then on. It doesn't change. It hasn't changed in 20 years. I can tell you when it's going to happen every time, and it's just the way it is.
Well,
it doesn't matter if it's cold. It doesn't matter if it's hot.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a full moon. It doesn't matter if it's a dark of the moon. It really makes no difference.
Wow.
You know?
Well, I know because you've done your own personal research very, very extensive, and a lot of it's because who you are, but a lot of it is because you understood what it takes in your profession that you worked at. You know what it takes to do research and what you need to do. We'll call it in the laboratory. Laboratory might be a spreadsheet, might be something, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you,
right.
Where can a person access that? I don't want to encourage someone not to buy the moon phase calendar, but that's up to them. But I assume
that's up to them.
Yeah, there's an access to this.
We had it accessed when I was doing the podcast, but
yeah.
We discontinued the podcast, and I've retired, so I haven't made it accessible yet. We did keep that calendar, the
yeah.
calculations for that at a coffee fact, which we dealt with Hemisphere Coffee for years.
Oh, I remember that
as a sponsor for us.
Yeah,
and so at Hunter's Blend Coffee, they had that. The calculator on Hunter's Blend Coffee. It's a pull-down menu at the top of Hunter's Blend.
Yep.
So you can go to Hunter's Blend or get a hold of them, and they can do that. You can get the calculation from there.
What kind of information does one of our listeners need?
What you need to know is where your stand is, where you're going to be hunting. You need to know the town, the village that's closest to your stand.
Okay.
Not the zip code, not the you need the state and the village of a town of where you're hunting.
So as an
example, where you're at, in other words, let's say, for example, you were somewhere around Gaylord, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
You would list Gaylord. If there's another town, some small town between there that you're closer to, that's the town you would put in it. So we put this, we actually, I think, had about every little village there is
wow.
in the United States that's in this program.
That was no small feat developing that and putting that together.
No, it wasn't.
No, that's a
it wasn't.
Huge amount of work.
But
there.
Again, it was ahead of its time.
Yeah.
If people understood it, the importance of it, it would really be
yeah.
going crazy today.
Well, all
but
the
again,
all the efforts.
Let
in
me.
It. Yep. Go ahead.
The other thing is that the calculation of this has to do with looking at tables, sun tables. In other words, you can going to a calendar doesn't do you any good. You have to look at that day, that calendar day. For example, these listeners out here listening say, wow, I saw these bucks doing this, what he's talking about, last year, and it was November the 1st.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to go back to, and there's plenty of tables. And you can Google them up, plenty of tables.
Mm-hmm.
Almanac has tables and everything. You go back and Google those tables. You can get a table. And that date that you did that, you find out what the amount of light was during that day.
Yeah.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
And that number of the amount of light that was in that day is what you want to look at when you look at this year to see if those minutes of light's in this day this year.
Yeah.
I'm making it simple for you.
Yeah.
Now, the calculation of doing this is much more complicated than that, but that's a good, simple way of looking at how do I do this on my own without any help.
Yeah, look at the Google search, the list of the sun table light, and,
right.
and take that day in history, say 2 years ago.
Correct.
They said, you know, and they say, oh,
correct.
Okay. And then maybe team it up with another date that the similar activity was and match it up.
This coming year, plan on hunting your stand that same light day.
Yes. Yep. I know there's a simpler way, and that's probably through the calculator that's on Hunter's Blend
yep.
Coffee. Yeah. As we,
yeah,
my wife and I enjoy that coffee. It's not that we buy it every day but from them, but we'll put
mm-hmm.
in two or three different orders and get a number of bags of that.
Right.
So we take it to camp up in Bear Camp up in the UP.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and if you have a few listeners that can't get it any other way, you can just get in touch with you. I can hand calculate it in a few minutes. It takes me a few minutes, so I can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but it'll vary. For example, what I'm saying is,
yep.
If you're 20 miles north, maybe the same day, 20 miles north may not. So we're looking at about the range of a day of the day that you hunt would be about 30 miles.
Yeah.
In north to south here in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Now you have to realize as you approach the UP and upper towards Canada, it changes quicker.
Yeah, boy, you're right.
You see what I mean?
You betcha.
So your day, so there, a 20 miles may make a difference, quite a difference.
Yeah.
Now when you get down into Mississippi and Georgia, and this is where you have a problem. This is where a lot of biologists that will listen to this and other people says, no, you can't do that. You can't do that because down here in Georgia, it lasts, this rut lasts this many days. It lasts 10 days, 20 days, 30 days. They're right. You understand what I mean?
Yep.
Because the light change is so slow there that as it approaches that magic number,
yeah,
it doesn't hardly get there. So the does are coming in, not specifically that day like they are everywhere else.
Yeah.
That's why the rut is much harder to predict in those southern, very southern states than the northern states.
Mm. Wow.
But it works.
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine that has been quite successful in Halo Chronicles. They got a site, Henry and Lakeisha Woodard. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they've come to two of my workshops. All the way from Mississippi.
Yeah, they're on the social media quite a bit.
Yeah.
They're a fun couple to follow.
They are.
Or family,
they are.
I should say. Because
quite a family, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. There's some hardcore hunters right there.
They are.
But
they
they're always sporting a good smile on their face, I know that.
Yeah, they are. That's right.
Yeah.
So they're in tune with what I'm talking about. And so, again, you can do a lot of this with your own research by looking at the amount of sunlight in that day. And then, but I won't get into the uncertainties part of it, but there is some uncertainty, and it has to do with the light tables.
Mm-hmm.
If you pull up two or three light tables, they will not agree that within a few minutes of light, they'll be off a minute or two.
Okay.
Well, that's the uncertainty you've got in the calculation.
Yeah.
So whenever they disagree, I always, if I'm telling you folks out there, listeners, I would take the latter. Don't go early.
Yeah. Yep.
Wait till the next day to go. It's better go late a day or two than it is to go early.
Yeah.
See?
Hunt the tinker spots.
Hunt the tinker state.
You just can't stand sitting in the living room watching Jeopardy reruns. Well, hunt the tinker stands. Get off
hunt the
couch.
Tinker stands.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Jerry, this has been this has been more enjoyable than the first one, which was the second one is more enjoyable than the first one too. But this, I mean, this is intriguing every time. I feel like it's that first, you know, opening day of gun season or bow season or muzzleloading season. This podcast has that feeling like every time. It's like, oh man, this is so much fun and just that kid in the candy store feel, I should say. This is and for a lot of people, or maybe for a good sum of people, looking things up on a light table might be just what they want to do because that's the way they're wired. But a lot of people will say, I just want to cut to the chase and get those dates.
Exactly. Well, I have a lot of people that do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of do. And yeah. I have quite a few people that'll contact me, and it'll vary, for example, from the end of October to in December, actually. I had this friend that was in Texas now, and he came from Texas originally, and he was the music director in a large church here in Ohio, and he started hunting here in Ohio, and he wasn't introduced to it until he got here.
Yeah.
And he just went back to Texas this year, to a job there, and he texted me, I don't know, tomorrow's Christmas, he says, tomorrow's Christmas, just like Christmas. And he couldn't wait until the day, the opening, you know, to the key day to start. And by, he killed a buck that day, a nice buck in Texas.
Wow.
And he said, this is amazing.
Yeah.
He says, here it is. And up here in Ohio, it was in November, and we're in December, and it worked.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, it works.
You bet.
And once you know that, it's that light that triggers those does.
Yeah. Once you know how to find out what those dates are, and like you said, another key thing is that's going to change from 1 year to the next, mm-hmm. or it may, and likely will over time, but it's going to kind
at of... At any one location, it'll change plus a couple of days, minus a couple of days. So okay. You got a range of 4 days max.
Yeah, but like you say, you don't want to...
At one location.
You don't want to... You know, you don't want to...
Except down in the far room. South, as I said.
Yeah, okay.
Down in the far south, it's in the southern states, it's harder.
In that Black Belt area?
I'm saying in that area of lower Georgia, that lower area, Alabama, you know, Mississippi, down in the lower part.
Yeah.
Where the sun... Actually, the fact of it is, this number... this tangent that I'm talking about, that once you find that it out, it doesn't reach that down there. That's why that's why it's so hard for people to say, what's going on? What's going on?
Yeah.
They're still rutting.
Yeah.
Because it's just not as specific.
Yeah.
The light changes and it's specific.
I remember I read an article a number of years ago. They call it that Black Belt area for whatever the reason, has something to do with the dynamics of the deer, I think. But
I've read those articles, and I'm telling you, Gary, they can say all they want to.
Yeah.
They think it's the subspecies. I've had them. I'm talking about biologists. I'm talking about DNR people. They've published articles saying because of this subspecies and this whitetail's here, and we got more of this subspecies over here, and they predict the rut in this part of the state and then over here in this part of the state.
Wow.
And they don't – I mean, they should know.
Yeah.
They should know. It has to do with the change in light, and you guys' light changes so slow.
Yeah.
Therefore, they don't know what to do.
Yeah. I don't want to –
the deer go in or they don't go in. Now, the bucks is ready anytime. You understand what I mean?
Yep.
Bucks are ready anytime. They're ready to breed.
From
period.
The time, from like you said, the time that they're velvet falls.
Out of velvet.
Yeah.
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 They're fighting. They'll breed. They'll breed right up and like, I had bucks, and when I talk about cameras, my cameras come a long way,
mm-hmm.
and I got got cell cameras now, but I don't care what camera you got, you better know how to use it.
Put
it high where they can't see it, then making noise and light and blackout cameras, so. Camera is your worst enemy on your best rut stand.
Yeah.
You don't put them on your rut stand. But I use them on tinker stands, and I have research stands that I've used them on.
Well,
that
was exactly that what you just said. I call it a Jerryism. I shared that with my buddy once. He switched to Jerryism. It's some of these really critical, important things that we just don't, you know, we would pass off as, that's gibberish. And I said, put your cameras high. Because
high,
yeah, and he says, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "I have an old ladder stand that was really narrow, and I have it's comprised of three sections. I don't use that stand because it's just not safe." And I said, "I take the two bottom things and I wrap a bungee around them, and that's what I carry in the woods to put a camera up." He said, "For what?"
Yeah.
I said, "Everything, whatever I'm doing." I said, "It's a bonus for a lot of things. So you know, it prevents a little bit of theft too, but." But also, you know, like you say, bear season. Oh, what a change once I did that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, they can smell that as cameras even. I mean, their scent, the noses are just unbelievable. People underestimate their nose. Now, once they get used to it, it's a whole different story. But, again, pressure, that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, it
pressure
is.
Pressure is a whole other story.
Yeah.
But we're saying pressure, hunting it too early, it's pressure, and you're not going to do any good. So maximize your time to go, but, that's key.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Jerry, I'm looking at the timeline. Yeah. We've been doing this for a while. You know what? It's like anything. Time passes quickly when you're having a good time, but isn't it a good time when we're talking about deer hunting and stuff anyways?
We all know
that.
Correct.
Yeah, but you know, this is, there are so many takeaways, but it's really boils down to kind of that refined process that we've as a hunting society have overcomplicated things, but that's what we do as human beings sometimes. But it's a fun time trying to figure these things out, and we're hoping that our listeners, if we reach across their spectrum and they at least give it a try, they got nothing to really to lose and everything to gain, because even if they say, well, time-wise, when is it not a lot of fun going out into the woods and doing a little something like this in point in case, giving it a try and putting that, I call it the nose jam concept. And, yeah, boy, we appreciate you still. Sharing with us.
I appreciate that, Gary. I appreciate it. I've been in the, what you say, instructing or teaching in most of my life, some way and somehow. So it kind of, I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I would like to though come back and kind of summarize this a little bit.
Please.
Saying, okay, what I've given you in terms of the stages and what happens, this does happen. You may be calling them different stages, different names and so forth, but this is what happens. So try to maximize that time period and do it. And you can figure a lot of it out on your own. And I'm not saying don't hunt your other stands. Just be smart about keeping the pressure off the key stands.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I'm saying is make these licking branches and these scrapes around your stands. Even if, I don't care if you're hunting it a lot or you only hunt it 1-2 days out of the year, you're maximizing that stand by bringing these deer's attention to where you're at.
Wow.
So use some of this. If you're not going to use all of it, use some of what Gary and I have talked about today, and you'll see your odds in hunting and your enjoyment of hunting will go up.
Yeah. Now, that's exactly it. Not just the odds of harvesting, but we'll have a more enjoyable experience out in the woods because of it all. Yeah. Jerry, this has been another pleasurable experience discussing our hunting and deer hunting endeavors and what it takes to enjoy it just a little bit more than we had been, or maybe in this case the potential of enjoying our hunt out in the woods a lot more than we have been in the past. A lot of us can grumble about maybe a couple of bum seasons here and there and everywhere, and I've done that. But, boy, when you've got some light at the end of the tunnel that says, it doesn't have to be that way, we're not guaranteeing that you're going to harvest something, but we're telling you that if you're tired of the old, it doesn't have to be that way. Give it a try.
I agree.
Thanks very much, Jerry. I really appreciate it. And
My pleasure.
Yeah, your cottage is not that far from where I'm at. I'm closer than I was before, so I would really enjoy stopping up, and I'll say hi to our mutual friend Tom at the same time, and we'll maybe grab a glass of iced tea or something and sit on your deck and look out in front and enjoy that beautiful scenery that you have up there.
Watch those freighters go by.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Jerry, thank you
Looking
so much.
Looking forward to it, Gary.
Hey, God bless in all you do, bud. I know it's been a challenging year, but hey, you're like you always do. You make the best of things, and you just are. And better days are always ahead. That's for sure.
I agree.
All right. God bless.
You have a blessed day, Gary.
Thank you. Bye bye.
This week's podcast brought to you by.
Now that Michigan is a no-bait state, your food plot success is more important than ever. The Food Plot Shop is your best resource for trusted advice and sensible seed blends. Call 248-798-2361 or visit us at thefoodplotshop.com.
And also brought to you by
Bourbon Creek Gun Dogs and Guides, Northern Michigan's finest upland bird put and take preserve. Our private lands have been carefully groomed to give you a blue ribbon experience. Bring your dog or have our guides bring their expertly trained German Shorthair for a fun-filled day. At your request, we also guide on other properties. We are located in the heart of Michigan's elk country. Find us at bourboncreekgundogs.com or on Facebook, or give us a call at 989-858-6799 to book your next upland bird hunting experience.
And with that, we conclude another podcast episode with Wild Game Dynasty. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe in your podcast app to receive notifications on future podcasts. Also, please head on over and check out our Facebook page. Be sure to like and follow it to stay up to date on highlights from our clients' turkey, bear, and white-tailed deer hunts. Until next time, guys, stay safe, enjoy the great outdoors, and happy hunting.